The views and opinions expressed on the following program are those of the producers and or the persons appearing on the program, and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of CIUT-FM.
Zewadam sadin Indigenous Wave CIUT satdegunni wasajotu yujistokore wisk FM.
You're listening to Indigenous Waves on CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Jenny Blackbird.
And I'm Jennifer Sylvester.
All right, back from special assignment.
Yes.
And so this is Indigenous Waves, and we are broadcasting live from Dish with One Spoon territory. So that was Graham Jones with The Flood. And that congratulations, Graham, on your number one on the Indigenous Music Countdown.
Oh, nice. Awesome.
Yeah, and we had Graham on the show last year, and we had a really, really kick-ass interview with him. So it's really nice to see. It's nice to see folks that have visited the show do really well.
And, well, yes.
Yeah. Yay. So we have a special guest on the line here. We've got Desni Trevina. So I'm just going to pull up Desni on the phone. Hopefully this will work. Dansei, Desni.
Hi.
How
is everyone?
Ooh, hold
Can
on
you
one
hear
second.
Me?
We got feedback.
Oh. Okay, is that working? Yeah, we got
lots. Okay, we got lots of feedback happening here. I'm not sure what is going on. We're going to have to play another song at, unless Jennifer wants to do the news. Do you have the news pulled up?
Yeah,
because this is a lot of feedback. I got to figure this out. Okay.
Can you hear me now?
I can, but it's incredible feedback in the studio. Okay, hold on one second.
Yeah, I got the news.
Okay, so why don't we just go to Jennifer with the news and we'll figure out this feedback situation. Okay, thank you.
All right, so not the best thing, but on top of the list that we have in regards to what's going on in Indigenous nightlife here in Toronto, around the GTA, Graham Jones, as we just heard, track The Flood was just reached number one on the Indigenous Music Countdown. And also we have the screening of Ever Deadly, March 12th, starting at 5:30, and it goes to 8:30 at the Equity, Diversion, and Inclusion Office at the Faculty of Music. Is excited to invite our listeners and all those who are listening and around the campus area and Greater Toronto area to a free screening, film screening of Ever Deadly to commemorate International Women's Day, which will be, what's today? So today's the 11th, so it's tomorrow. And it's going to be an incredible screening of the film with a panel discussion. We'll follow up with which is open to everyone. The screening will occur in person and will also be live streamed. Live freshmen will be served. And the location of this event is at Faculty of Music in Walter Hall at 80 Queens Park, Toronto. So any information, if you just look up the Faculty of Music or go to indigenous.utoronto.ca and you'll see all the campus events on that website under events. And as well, we have the Adrian Sutherland Show at the Cameron House on March 14th, which is this coming Thursday. Adrian will be premiering some brand new songs and will be releasing his second album, Precious Diamonds, on March 15th, which is Friday. Tickets are on his website for $15 in advance and $20 at the door. So if you want more information, go to adriansutherlandmusic.com/shows. And the Cameron House is located at 408 Queen Street West, Toronto, Ontario. And that's the Queen Subway. That's where you want to go. And we also have an ambient evening of Indigenous World Fusion of Music, Culture, and Storytelling this Saturday, March 16th at 672 College Street at Beatrice. And it's the Sellers and Newell Secondhand Books. And the doors open at 7, the show's at 8. $25 minimum donation to the artists. And to reserve, call 647-778-6345. Or you can email at sellers@sellersandnewell.com. So it's Stone Carver Activist. And that's Stone Carver. Stone Carver Activist and Musician event. This coming Saturday.
That's amazing. Thank you so much, Jennifer. I'm going to pull up Desney on the line. Okay. And if you want to take the reins on this one so that I don't have an incredible amount of feedback in here.
Okay.
Anyway, so here's Desney.
Hi, everyone.
Hi, Desney.
How are you all?
We figured it all out.
That's okay. That's okay.
So you're on our show to tell us about your new book that you released today, In the Darkness, A Match Was Lit. Can you give us a little bit? First of all, tell us more a little bit about you, and then we can go into, and you can sort of give a little synopsis of your upcoming book.
Well, my name is Desney, and I am, you know, before I started talking, I was thinking to myself, what if someone asks you, who are you?
Mm.
And I'm thinking, I don't know. So I'm a mother. I'm a nanny. I am a warrior. I'm a survivor. I work in the field of trauma and addictions and mental health. I'm also the co-owner or creator of the Afro-Indigenous Community Market. I was supposed to come on the last time, but the time it just didn't happen, which was okay.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm in the community. I'm at a number of places dealing with people with addictions. I, too, am a recovering drug addict and alcoholic. I'm a daughter of an addict who was killed when she was 29.
Mm-hmm.
So I have a long history of not so good things. But, you know, I guess I would say in a nutshell is I am someone who just wants to be a part of the solution as opposed to the problem.
So
I think that's it.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for sharing. And there's a lot to you in regards to your book that I have some notes in regards to. It's basically a story a lot about that sort of, here it says, an honest and powerful firsthand account of intergenerational trauma, abuse, recovery, and healing.
Yes.
And which is very topical in regards to, especially when it comes to discussing, as you just experienced, the indigenous lived experience.
Mm-hmm.
Some of us are all sort of, at some point we're all sort of tied to or experienced or enthralled within traumas, and which sort of brings a lot of people to self-medicate and all that. So your book sort of goes into that
mm-hmm.
narrative. You seem to be like a natural storyteller. When did you decide to write your book?
You know, when I started getting sober, which was years ago, I always said I would love to write a book, but it was always impassioned. And actually, there was many people who would come up to me and say, Desney, you should write a book. Because, these were the days when I would be in AA, NA, any of those anonymous meetings trying to get sober. And I listened and I took it in and, life just happened. It was always in the back, but something told me, as a healing tool for me, that I needed to do this. I've done the work on myself. I continue to do the work because, I've spent over 25 years out there on hardcore drugs.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a lifetime even prior to me being on drugs. So it's going to take me my whole life to heal, right? Mm-hmm. To continue this journey. So I figured, this was the next step in my healing journey was to tell the story. And, the book is there and not all of it's in there. And when people who've read the book, they said to me, Desney, I felt like I was in a therapy session and we were talking, but the therapist says, oops, our time is up. Let's resume next week.
Mm-hmm.
That's what everyone felt like. It's not over. Mm-hmm. We're not done. Because I guess when you read it, you know it's not done. There's so much more. And I wanted to make sure, or I tried my best, not to make it a story of complete trauma.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because I could. I'm sure you can only imagine if I say that I've been out in those streets and on hardcore drugs for 25 years. That is not, a skip in the park. That comes with brutality, right?
Mm-hmm.
And everything else in between. So, yeah,
So, I love how you tapped on in regards to, the therapist, because at the beginning of your book, you write a literal love letter to your own children or to your children, and it's as an apology of the past,
mm-hmm.
and that's so great. And I find a lot of people don't take to understand the structure of an apology and I don't know. Yeah, I don't know. Can you what made you think that was how you wanted at the beginning of your book too?
Well, first off, all of my children have been affected by my drug addiction, mm-hmm. right? All of them in some way. The youngest one, not so much, but I was away from the youngest for a long period of time.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, for a period of time. But I needed them to know, even though I took them individually when I was getting sober, I needed them to know that it wasn't their fault. I needed them to know that despite them thinking otherwise, that they were everything to me. But I had a disease of addiction. And I, unfortunately, they couldn't, their love and their need for me couldn't get me to stop.
Hmm.
So I needed to make those dedications to each of them. And the sad thing is right now, my first dedication is to my oldest child, Cameron. Unfortunately, my son Cameron died of a fentanyl overdose July 31st of last year.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm in the utmost grief and mourning right now.
Mm-hmm.
However, I haven't stopped doing what I'm doing. You know, I always thought, why was I put on this earth? Why?
Mm-hmm.
You know, you took my mother through drugs in Allen Gardens with a hot shot in 1981. She was 29. You put me through 25 years of pure hell of addiction. My son became addict, and now you've taken my child from me.
Mm-hmm.
And not once when I went where my son was, I ran to that house, and I laid on the ground with my dead son. I laid with him to let him know that I loved him and that I would be okay. I promised that I would not relapse over this. And not once was it a thought. Not once. And I say this only for the fact that for other people who are struggling, you know, with addiction and they believe they can't do it, I've done the work. So the 16 years of my sobriety, unfortunately and fortunately, has prepared me to bury my son. And for those that are not, you know, they're not in addiction and they haven't done the work, they will never understand that. I am a drug addict of the worst kind. So my first thought in anything, in everything I used to do, would be drugs.
Mm-hmm.
So my son is gone. I've laid with my son on this dirty floor in this apartment, dead. While everyone's around me crying, I'm laying, kissing my son, rubbing his head. I should have gotten up from there and dug a hole and went in there with him.
Mm-hmm.
Normally I would have, but I didn't, and I won't.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm here to help other people. I know that now. And the 25 years that I've spent pretty much on my face in a hole was to be able to help others come out of that if they choose to.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the dedication is there, and it kills me. I haven't even read it. My daughters will read it and pick it up and say, Mom, it's so difficult to read that, knowing that I'm praying for him, and I want him to come out of jail and be the best version of himself. And when he came out, he was out for 7 days. That was it.
Hmm.
7 days. So it's heartbreaking, it's devastating, but again, my kids needed to know, and they still need to know, you know, that none of what you went through, or I put them through, was their fault. That's why there were dedications to each of them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And thank you for sharing that. That's really powerful to share your personal story, personal journey. And for some, achieving sobriety can be a decades-long process, and there's a lot that, like you said, there's a lot that get hurt in the process as we're dealing with the addictions process. And unfortunately, this is not unfortunately, but that's just sort of like this, like I said at the top of the show, is like this is the lived experience of many Indigenous families in Toronto.
Yeah.
And what are the key things that assisted you in your sobriety journey?
Oh, boy. The key things, you know, my last relapse was, I think, 2007. I think that's when it was. The key thing was I knew I was not meant to be here. Now, don't get me wrong. None of us are meant to be there. You know what I mean? None of us are. But I had attained a little bit of sobriety, and I knew that that little bit of sobriety that I had attained was enough to shift me just a little bit to know that, you know what, I don't want to be down here no more. My stomp is Regent Park. My stomp is, you know, Sherbourne, all of that. In fact, yeah, realistically, my stomp was really wherever the drugs were, but my main base was downtown. Mm-hmm. And animals were living better than me. Like, really, when you're in the trenches of this, oh, you know, you don't bathe. You're up all night. You're not eating the things, not to mention the things that one does to feed the habit. It was just too much. And, you know, I tried many times to get sober. I went to treatment 3 times. I went to detox 8 times, one even being pregnant, big old belly in detox. So I tried, but the thing about it was that I didn't, I guess you could say I didn't fully surrender. And it really probably wasn't until I tapped into my indigenity, right?
Mm-hmm.
That I started doing the Red Road to Sobriety book, which is based out of Colorado from Don Coyes. And there was something in this book. It said to my spirit. I'm not saying that AA, CA, and all of them didn't help. They certainly helped me get to a place. But it wasn't enough because I didn't really surrender to the process. But when I got into my culture, or learning the culture, learning the traditions, acknowledging who I am in my authenticity as a Black, Native, and White, Irish, and Scottish woman. So that's when I was just like, you know what, Creator, take me. I've congested and I ingested so many drugs. I wanted to die, but I woke up again, and that's when I said, I can't do this anymore. Either take me out of my misery, or get me out of this madness. And Creator dragged me out, and I fully surrendered. I was done. And I took a bad beating at that time as well. But I was done. I was just done.
Hmm.
Yeah.
And your book is written in such a reader-friendly way. So, like, it's not sort of a boundary for those who are sort of seeking to read someone else's experience and sort of see themselves in literary form. And was it easy or difficult for you to write this book?
It was difficult, and I remember stopping for like 2 or 3 months, and my editor said to me, because this, I guess this is the way he needed to come to me, was that, listen, my time is valuable. So you know what? Realistically, I finished the book because I was too worried about this person's time,
mm-hmm.
right? Because when I got to the trauma and the, you know, the rapes and the sodomizing and all of those things that had happened to me, I had to put it down. I could not. It was too much. It felt like there was a brick or something just heavy on my head and my shoulders. I was drained emotionally. It was not easy. But when I made the quick commitment, I was able to spit it out quickly. And a lot of the stuff in there, it's not even half of what I've been through, you know? Mm-hmm. And it wasn't because I was choosing to keep certain things out. It was because I don't remember a lot of it, too. You know, it'll come randomly. You know, there's times I can be out there and be triggered by a smell or a picture or anything. So, and realistically, do you want to know 150, you know, different assaults and things and all that happened to me? I don't know. So hopefully I chose enough, and everyone pretty much got the gist of my life,
mm-hmm.
right? And I'm very raw and real.
Mm-hmm.
I'm very honest. And the reason I am now is because it was shame that kept me sick in my disease. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I have a lot of things to be ashamed of. I do. I've done a lot of bad things out there to people, to myself. But if I continue to shame and feel the shame and walk with that, I will never stay sober. So instead of walking with this shame, I decided just to lift my head up because these things happen to me. These things I've done. But these things are not who I am as a person, as a warrior, as a soldier, right?
Mm-hmm.
My addiction has taken me to places that I could not even imagine, and a normal person could never imagine. So I just like, you know what? I need to keep it real, and I think that's why a lot of people are attracted to me in that way, because I don't pussyfoot around. I don't, I just keep it real.
Mm-hmm.
I have to.
You sort of touch a lot in regards like to your journey to sobriety. What are some words of advice can you offer to others that are wanting to achieve sobriety or work within harm reduction field?
Never give up. And hang around people that want to help you or elevate you, right? I mean, misery loves company.
Mm-hmm.
Trauma bonding is real, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to go, you know, to some people that don't use and really talk with them. So I would say trust yourself. Like, if you want this, it doesn't matter how far down you went or what you've done, you can do this. Seek out the help. Forgive yourself. If it's harm reduction, create a safety plan. Even if it's not harm reduction and you want complete abstinence, create a safety plan. I know you, the person who's struggling and is challenged, they're not going to be able to create a safety plan because they don't know, number one, what a safety plan really is,
mm-hmm.
because they're in it. When you're in the trenches, you don't see anything outside of those trenches, right? So you need to find somebody that can help you with this.
Mm-hmm. So that runs into the next thing I wanted to bring up. So you run Wellbriety Circles in Toronto. Could you tell us
yes.
a little about Wellbriety?
Absolutely. The thing I love about Wellbriety is that it encompasses everything. You know, culturally based, your mind, you know, your body, your spirit, your emotional, your mental, everything. Because sobriety, and it's no disrespect to any anonymous meetings for those that, you know, don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I love my beginnings. But it didn't really focus on, like my other anonymous meetings, it didn't focus on the whole of me, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I don't even know how I came about finding the red road to Wellbriety. I don't even know. I just know that I did. I purchased the books and...